Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. This show is an interview with Sir Christopher Frayling about Ennio Morricone, the most famous film composer of all time. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, good afternoon, listeners, and with great pleasure and honour that I welcome to our sofa here Sir Christopher Frayling, a pop culture guru who's known for his knowledge of Sergio Leone's work and spaghetti westerns in general. And I'm delighted to say that he's agreed to come along and talk with me about the life and career of Ennio Morricone, who died recently, sadly. He was probably the most famous of all the film composers and is remembered for his scoring, especially of spaghetti westerns, although we know he did a lot of other stuff as well. I mean, his credits run to over 400 film scores, which means an average of about 6 films a year over 70 years. I mean, Chris, what do you think about this amazing body of work that he's got?
Well, it's extraordinary. I once said to him, I did a bit of maths like you about how long this body, because it's not just the film scores, 400 plus, there's 100 concert pieces. There's all these arrangements for people like Mario Lanza and Italian pop singers and so on. And you add it all up. It's an astonishing body of work. He said, compared to Bach, I'm almost unemployed. I said, why? He said, well, Bach had to produce a mass every Sunday in the churches he was working in. So he'd work on the mass at the beginning of the week. He'd rehearse it with the organist and the choir master. So he said, you know, he's having to do 52 masses a year. Compared to Bach, and indeed Mozart, I'm virtually unemployed. I said, well, I think it's still a hell of a lot of work. Not least because unlike a lot of composers of film music who just sort of whistle the melody and get someone to arrange it, he does all the arrangements as well, because he reckoned that the arrangement and the orchestration were part of the composing, that you can't really call yourself a composer unless you can arrange. So he had all this, the lines and staves, the manuscript paper of music in his study, and he would write out in pencil each part for each instrumentalist in the orchestra for every piece of music he did. So for the statistics you've mentioned, you multiply that by all the parts for all the musicians. Yeah. It is an astonishing thing. He's quite a prodigy. I mean, he could think the orchestration in his head and simply write down all the instruments on his manuscript paper. And woe betide anybody who went into his room. I visited his apartment in Rome off the Piazza Venezia a couple of times, and there's this iron door with screws in it, a soundproof door which led into the study, and he kept the key in his pocket. As he told me, the cleaning lady wasn't allowed in, his wife wasn't allowed in, because he had all these bits of manuscript paper lying all over the office, and he had to keep them absolutely in his head. So woe betide anyone who went in. That was the secret room. And I asked him once, can I go in? He said, no, nobody goes in except for me. That's where I do the composing. So virtually unemployed compared to Bach.
Thank you.
Ennio's early life, not much is known. I mean, I know he had four brothers and sisters, and he studied trumpet. He was born in Rome, and his father was a trumpeter.
Yeah.
And he wrote his first composition at the age of six.
Yeah.
So can you shed any more light on his early years?
Yeah, his dad was a trumpeter who played in a nightclub band, a jazz band. And during the war, because, you know, Rome in the war, he's born in 1928, Morricone. So when the war broke out, he's in his early to mid-teens. And first of all, you have the rise of Mussolini. So he grows up under the fascist regime. Then you have the Nazi invasion of Rome. And then you have the Allied bombing of Rome as the American and British and Allied troops march north from Salerno. So he's had sort of three regimes by the time he's in his late teens. And his dad wanted him to help out in the nightclub band. So that's how he first started playing the trumpet, with his subbing for his dad. He then goes to the music conservatory to study trumpet to start with. At the age of 10, it's a two-year course, which he does in 6 months. And he then moves into harmony, and he then moves into composition. So by now, it's the end of the war. He's trying to earn an extra few bob for the family by playing the trumpet. As he said, he'd play for cigarettes, which he doesn't smoke, so swap it for food. And it was a very, very difficult time. And he once said that the strange nostalgia of a lot of his music, this extraordinary yearning for the past that you get, particularly in his later work, you get this sense of going back to his childhood and remembering, you know, difficult times, but also the good times of growing up with the family. And he remained a very devout Catholic all his life, went to Mass regularly, very studious, very quiet, not a awfully humorous man, quite difficult to interview, because you'd ask him a question and there'd be this terrifying pause as he was thinking out the answer. No glib answers, no, you know, stock answers to questions. And so out of this background, he's very studious, a prodigy with music at a very, very young age. And in the early 50s, 1950s, he has to decide, do I become a classical composer and do a bit of teaching to pay the rent? By now he's got a young family. Or do I move into more commercial areas? And he decides, slightly reluctantly, because even when he was interviewed in his 80s, he would say, you know, people look down on me for not being a classical composer. They're a bit snobbish, particularly in Rome. But he makes the decision. And he, so throughout the 50s, he works for RCA Records, doing a lot of arranging for their albums, and also for Rai, the Italian state broadcaster, for television. So he starts off as an arranger. So out of his composition course at the conservatory, San Cecilia Academy, he becomes a music arranger, basically.
And didn't he do so? He did a bit of work on the radio as well, didn't he?
Also radio. Yeah. And so I think a key moment in the 50s for him, he went to a seminar with John Cage in Darmstadt in 1958. And John Cage had these revolutionary ideas about music. I mean, the use of silence, the use of natural sounds out of their usual context, put into music, that context is everything. And that in the context of the concert hall, all sounds become music. So the famous thing of the piece by John Cage, where he doesn't play anything, he just has a metronome on the piano. And so all the rustling of the suites and people coughing and shuffling their legs all becomes music. And in fact, Morricone told me a very nice story. He said he went to a concert in 1967 in Florence, an avant-garde post-John Cage concert, where he was playing in the first half of the concert. And the second half of the concert, the audience came back after the interval. And they kept talking, and the concert didn't begin. But they noticed a man had put a metal ladder on the stage, up to the balcony on the stage, and was walking up this metal ladder. And they thought, oh, he must be a workman working on the sound system or something. And nobody paid any attention. And he was making lots of squeaking noises with this ladder and holding a microphone close to the ladder. And they suddenly realised this was the concert.
Right.
And they all sort of stopped talking. And it caused a bit of a scandal, this thing. This guy was doing a Cage and how, you know, this symphony for metal ladder. Yeah. That night, Morricone phoned Sergio Leone. He said, why don't you do the opening scene of Once Upon a Time in the West entirely on the basis of amplified natural sounds? A windmill that needs oiling, flies that are buzzing, a door that's creaking, the telegraph is going, all this, etc. And you layer all these natural sounds, and it all arose out of an avant-garde John Cage concert in Florence. Battle of Algiers. The director of the film Battle of Algiers, 1965, Gillo Pontecorvo, had been to see for a few dollars more, very impressed with the music. But Pontecorvo was himself a bit of a musician, and he was contracted, the one and only time in Morricone's career, to share the credit with the composer. So it says music composed by Gillo Pontecorvo and Ennio Morricone on the credits. And I asked Ennio, I said, you know, you don't like sharing the credit. You like doing it yourself. He said, I know. The only thing that Pontecorvo composed was three notes. I said, oh, yes. He said, it's the theme for the freedom fighter, Ali Lapointe, in the Battle of Algiers. That's it. That's what Pontecorvo. The rest is me. And in particular, Morricone composed this march for the arrival of the French paras. It's the Algerian War of Independence, 10 years before 1965. The paras arrive in their berets, marching down a street in Algeria. And it's a march with insistent drumbeat and horns. And it's a great piece, which Morricone included in his concerts. It was a real rouser. And of his non-spaghetti soundtracks, it was his most famous at the time, The Battle of Algiers.
So he became a top studio arranger at RCA Victor, and he was working a lot with the sort of the pop stars at the time, isn't that right? Mario Lanza, Rita Pavone, and I guess he was in the hit parade more often than not.
He was. Two great hits he made, but apart from the Mario Lanza, you know, the great Italian-American tenor who became a huge hit in America and made films, in fact. His first big hit was called Il Barattolo, which means the tin can. And it was sung by an Italian pop singer called Gianni Meccia. And the lyric was about kicking a tin can down the hill, and it's like life. This thing rolls down the hill, etc., etc. But of course, being Morricone, he had to include the sounds of tin cans,
of course,
etc. And then he did one called "Se Telefonando," which was sung by a pop singer called Mina, where you get all the telephone noises as well. So he became quite well known for arrangements that are a bit more than arrangements. They're things that linger in the mind after you've heard the song and sort of separated from the song.
Sort of hooks, almost.
Yeah, and he. I mean, famously, he then, in the early 60s, and I remember it's the era of folk music and the Kingston Trio and Pete Seeger, just pre-Bob Dylan, and Woody Guthrie. There's a cult of Woody Guthrie. So he does an arrangement of a song called Pastures of Plenty by Woody Guthrie, sung by a Californian folk singer called Peter Tevis, who happened to be in Rome. And it's an extraordinary arrangement, you know, pastures of plenty, and he adds layers. There's a manly chorus singing incomprehensible lyrics, and there's all sorts of natural sounds going on in the back, a bit of whipcrack and a bit of anvil and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
To give sort of texture to Pastures of Plenty, and the reason, and that became a sort of minor hit in Italy, but the reason it's significant is that when Sergio Leone visited Morricone and was discussing the main title of A Fistful of Dollars, the first of the films they collaborated on, Leone said, I want something a bit, you know, I don't want big symphonic American music. I don't want Aaron Copland or his two students, Elmer Bernstein and Jerome Morrow, you know, the big country, the Magnificent Seven. I don't want that big American folk sound. I want something that's a bit hip and a bit contemporary. And so Morricone played him Pastures of Plenty. And Leone said, we can all go home, we can go to the beach, take out the vocal line, I've found my main title. And it is identical to the main title of Fistful of Dollars. It was re-recorded. So you've got the choir, the anvil, the whip cracks, the grunts. You've got the Fender Stratocaster guitar, played by Alessandro Alessandroni, which is sort of shadowsy. Because we're pre-Beach Boys, it's more Telstar and the Shadows time.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 etc. And you've got this youthful sound that was so revolutionary, which accompanied A Fistful of Dollars.
Great. Well, let's take a listen to that.
It's a mighty hard road that these poor hands have hoed. My poor feet has traveled the hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rode through deserts so hot and mountains so cold. Well, I've wandered all over your green growing land, and wherever your crops are, I'll lend you my hand. On the edge of your cities, you'll see me, and then I come with the dust and I'm gone with the wind.
With the wind, with the wind.
California, Arizona, I've worked on your crops.
With the wind.
Then northward up to Oregon, I've gathered your hops.
With the wind.
I've dug beets from your ground and I've cut grapes from your vine to
wind.
Set on your table.
With the wind.
That light sparkling wine.
With the wind, with the wind.
It's green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground.
With the wind.
From the Grand Coulee Dam where the waters run down.
With the wind.
Every state of this union us migrants have been. We come with the dust and we're gone with the wind.
In 1961, his first film was Luciano Salci's satire Il Federale with Ugo Tognazzi.
Called The Fascist in English-speaking countries.
Yeah.
Yes, he had in fact done one or two things uncredited before then. He did one of the themes for Barabbas, this biblical epic, which was made in Italy and released internationally. But this was the first time his name had appeared on the credits.
And I think he ended up making a few films with Salci.
He did. And I think they knew each other from working on television. Salci was a television director, so that took him over into the movies. And in fact, the singer of the Pastures of Plenty had already sung two Western themes, which Morricone had written for Westerns, which were made before Fistful of Dollars. And people think Fistful of Dollars was the first Italian Western. It was the 24th.
Yeah.
But it was the first which really had a distinctive Italian kind of flavour to it. The other 23 are sort of copy American films in a way. And Peter Tevis had sung a ballad called Lonesome Billy for a film called Pistols Don't Argue, which was made by the same
That's
company
a great as Fistful of
Dollars. Lonesome Billy. and another, A Gringo Like Me, for a film called Gunfight at the Red Sands, both written by Morricone. But they sound like Reach Me Down, Dmitri Tiomkin. They don't sound Italian. They sound like ersatz American soundtracks. Mm. There's something about the relationship with Leone where they both clicked and they both innovated together and used the music in very distinctive ways. So it's not just wallpaper. I mean, the music, first of all, you have scenes where the entire scene gives space to the music. So you've got a scene without any dialogue for 3.5 minutes, so you can really expand the theme, usually a duel or a face-off of some sort, so allowing the music some space, but also using the music as a kind of punctuation. So you have Clint Eastwood standing there saying, why are you doing this for us? $500? On the soundtrack. It's like a piece of musical punctuation. What's going on in his head?
Almost operatic.
It is. It's like, in fact, I once called these films operas in which the arias aren't sung, they're stared.
That's a great phrase. Can I ask you about... So, I mean, his big breakthrough came, obviously, with Sergio Leone. Mm. And now they were classmates, weren't they?
They were. In fact, Leone had made one film before Fistful of Dollars, one credited film called The Colossus of Rhodes. And the composer for that was a man called Angelo Lavagnino. And Leone's first choice for Fistful of Dollars was Lavagnino, a very prolific Italian composer in the movies. But it was the producers of Fistful of Dollars said, who'd made Pistols Don't Argue and had employed Morricone. They said, try him. He's young, he's cheap stage. Why not use him? So Leone went round to see him, and only when they met did they realise they'd been to school together in the mid-1930s.
That's amazing.
They hadn't met for, I think, 28 years. And slowly the memories came out of being at the same school in Rome. And it became one of the great movie partnerships. You know, you think of Alfred Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann, or Nino Rota and Fellini, or, I don't know, John Williams and Spielberg, John Barry and early James Bond, all those things. Yeah, but this is even closer, I think, than those relationships. They were absolutely in sync. Leone couldn't... had no musical education himself. In fact, he couldn't hold a tune. But Morricone would sit at a piano at home, and Leone would say, look, I want a theme for this character. First of all, Leone would tell him the story and mime all the characters. Then he'd say, I want a theme for each of the characters. And how about this? And no. And they kind of knew when they'd got it right. And their great dream was to write the entire score before the movie was shot. And so you shoot the movie and cut the movie to a pre-existing soundtrack, which is very, very rare. I mean, in most films, then as now, you bring in the composer at the last minute.
End,
you've got a rough cut of the film. There's about a month to go before release. And you say, come on, get on with it with a stopwatch.
And they've got to do it in a rush.
Yeah, all of that. And whereas the dream came true in the last 20 minutes of The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, where, first of all, you have Eli Wallach playing a Mexican baddie rushing round and round a huge military cemetery with an amazing theme called The Ecstasy of Gold, which is very, very simple. Four notes, but, you know, like a lot of Morricone, a simple melody in very unusual orchestration. Bom, 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 bom. That's all it is. Mm. And then it builds up as Eli Wallach rushes round and round the cemetery. That was written in advance of the filming. And was filmed to the music. And then
they played the music while they were shooting.
Not in fact on The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. For Once Upon a Time in the West, they played it on the set on an open reel tape recorder through a PA system.
Great.
So they could all hear it.
Great.
But on The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, it had been composed and Leone had it in his mind, but they didn't actually play it on the set. I managed to ask all the actors at one stage, and none of them remembered it being played on the set. But they remembered that Leone had very strong ideas. We have a close up here. We have a hand creeping towards a gun. We have a hat, and these are all cuts to the music. And that the cemetery is followed by this duel, or triello in Italian, a triangular duel with the good, the bad, and the ugly standing in the middle of this huge cemetery with triumphant bullfight music on a mariachi trumpet, which gets bigger and bigger and bigger and lasts, you know, goodness knows how long. It's no longer to do with real time, it's to do with film time. I mean, this thing, they just stare at each other for about 5 minutes with this building up theme. And those were written in advance. So the dream came. And then Once Upon a Time in the West, 1968, the entire score, every character, every piece of music was written in advance, recorded with a small orchestra, re-recorded after the film was shot and played on the set. And, you know, I've actually got a still of Claudio Cardinale in the Spanish desert. There's a trestle table. There's the open reel tape recorder. It's all wired up to a PA system. And this sentimental theme, her theme, Jill's theme from Once Upon a Time in the West is playing. I mean, remember, too, Leone didn't speak English. He just had one phrase, watch me, Clint, watch me, Eli. So he would act out the character on the screen and in the process turned it into a sort of Roman character by doing. But what created the atmosphere was the music.
Yeah.
So he'd mime, and then they'd switch on the music, and that got the atmosphere for the scene. And there's a moment in Once Upon a Time in the West where there's a crane shot. Cardinale arrives at a railway station at Flagstone, Arizona, and she stands in the ticket office and walks down the main street of the town, and the crane goes up as she walks, and it is exactly timed to a crescendo in the music, and they could only do that and knowing it to the second because the music was there being played. It's like a huge rock video in a way. that, yeah, you know, it's and in fact, I did an interview with Quentin Tarantino a couple of years ago for a book I did about all this, and he said he thinks that writing the music in advance and thinking about the themes of the movie in relation to that is the origin of the jukebox movie. I mean, yeah, the idea of have not,
it's like a big pop video.
Well, exactly, and I mean not necessarily getting specially composed music, but you choose your favourite cuts and you build, as he does, and build the movie around it.
That.
And, you know, whether it's everything from Pulp Fiction onwards or Baby Driver, all these spin-offs from Tarantino, all starts, he reckons, with Morricone writing the music in advance.
Fascinating. What an influence he's had.
Huge.
Chris, I wanted to ask you about Il Gruppo, this group of composers recording avant-garde improvisations, and that he was involved in, and I think he helped to form this group.
Yeah.
And that must have sort of helped him influence his bizarre choice of orchestrations and arrangement. Do you know much about that?
Yes, yes. They called themselves the Nuova Consonanza, the New Consonanza. And yes, they were taking the ideas of John Cage, which they picked up in the late 50s, and recording it as with all sorts of natural sounds being used, traffic noises, all sorts of things woven into the music. And twice I asked Morricone about the relationship between those experiments in the 60s and his film music. And he always said, no, there's two worlds I belong to. There's the world of what he called absolute music, assoluta, which means concert music, classical music, freestanding music, and applied music, applicata, which is film music and film music with a purpose. Yeah. And he said, with my applicata, you can't think about the... I said, listen, just listen to Fistful of Dollars, listen to... You can see it. I mean, there's an extraordinary use of natural sounds and silences and single notes held forever and instruments sounding like cartoon versions of themselves. I mean, all of this stuff, which relates to those music. And eventually he said, OK, well, maybe there was a connection. But he had this funny hierarchy, and he said there was the serious stuff, the classical music, which appealed to the music establishment in Rome, and they all rated, and indeed the Nuova Consonanza that was rated as serious, and there was the movie music, which was treated as a kind of craft.
Yeah, you couldn't sort of almost couldn't treat it seriously in the same breath as the other.
It's odd, and like a lot of very successful people, there's always something you want out of life that you haven't quite got.
Yeah,
and he had that something was recognition by the classical music establishment.
By the serious musicians.
Why don't they? Eventually they came round, largely as a result of a lot of serious classical composers taking Morricone seriously outside Italy. And suddenly, you know, his influence seeps not into just rock music, but into film music and concert music. And they began to realise this guy is actually very, very influential indeed. Mm. But no, it was an odd kind of snobbery, which I don't think we had outside Italy. You know, he's not just a great film composer, he's a great composer. You know, you don't really have to say the word. But I think there's absolutely connections. Well, one of my favourite pieces that he wrote was for a film called A Fistful of Dynamite, or Once Upon a Time, The Revolution.
Duck You Sucker.
It had all sorts of titles. Leone was convinced that everyone went round in America saying, Duck You Sucker. And I don't think anybody in the world has ever
heard anyone say it for some reason.
And I think he misheard. You know, during the period of all our worries about the nuclear bomb in the 60s, the great slogan was Duck and Cover. You remember? You get under the table, duck and cover. And I think he must have misheard it. And he thought everyone was saying, Duck, you sucker, all the time. Anyway, so he calls the film Duck, You Sucker, which was retitled A Fistful of Dynamite to make it sound like A Fistful of Dollars. And in France, Il était une fois la Révolution, Once Upon a Time, the Revolution. It's a great title.
Yes, yeah.
And in it, there's a bunch of aristocrats have been in a coach and it's been hijacked by the bandits. And he makes them strip naked and humiliates them by that they're all walking down. And Leone wrote this extraordinary theme for it called The March of the Beggars, which is a sort of jaunty march played on a penny whistle, which is interrupted by these burping sounds as if they've eaten too much. And they've said, whoop, whoop. And indeed, Morricone did the burping. I asked him who did it. He said, I'm afraid I did. You know, whoop, whoop. And then, just to make it even more bizarre, it turns into Mozart's Eine kleine Nacht music. Ding, 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 ding. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of music. So you start with this march, you get burping noises, you get Mozart. And if that isn't an example of avant-garde music finding its way into film music, I really don't know what is.
What?
There's an even more extreme example, which he did in 1973. In at the very end of the spaghetti western boom, there was a film made called My Name Is Nobody, which Leone produced. He didn't direct. A man called Tonino Valerii directed it. And it finishes up with a showdown between Henry Fonda on one side of the railroad tracks and 150 riders in long coats who call themselves the Wild Bunch on the other side of the tracks. And needless to say, Henry Fonda wins, one against 150. But by that stage, it had got extreme. But how do you turn that into music? And what Morricone decided to do was to have a sort of parody of his theme from A Fistful of Dollars, but add to it The Ride of the Valkyries by Wagner, rearranged for car hooters. So you get the beginning of it is a sort of parody of Fistful of Dollars. Then you get wah, 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 wah. It is extraordinary, like a traffic jam in Rome.
Yeah.
Only it's the Ride of the Valkyries as these 150 Wild Bunch ride towards the railroad. It really is the most astonishing piece of music. One of the things, in addition to his melodies and his strange use of instruments, I think Morricone loved musical gags, particularly musical gags at the expense of classical music.
Yes.
Where he's being a bit ironic about classical music. So you have the odd snippet, which refers to it, and this is a very good example, I think.
Sort of almost like he's got a tiny little grudge against the powers that be in the classical music for not accepting
him. That's it. Two fingers up at the classical establishment in Rome. I think there's a bit of that going on, that if you're not going to take me seriously, you know, I'm going to blow a raspberry.
Morricone won an Oscar for a lifetime achievement, and then he got another for the Hateful Eight score recently, Tarantino film. Now, and he may have got a third for Once Upon a Time in the West, but the US distributor failed to submit the paperwork in time for a nomination.
That's it.
And then The Mission.
I think he was robbed on The Mission. In 1986, the film that won was called Round Midnight.
That's right.
It's a jazz thing where various jazz musicians play. And it was the Oscar for original soundtrack.
And
actually, a lot of the music in Round Midnight wasn't original.
Yeah.
It was standards rearranged for the movie. He was robbed. The Mission, I think, is one of his masterpieces. He always called it the film which technically and spiritually is closest to me.
He's actually sold 70 million copies of records, which is an amazing amazing achievement.
27 gold discs.
Is that what he had?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And people attribute to him the whole craze for buying movie soundtracks. I mean, Absolutely. They'd come out before, but they'd never been bestsellers before.
No.
They were kind of souvenirs of the movie. But suddenly it moved into the stratosphere with Fistful of Dollars, and they became, you know, and The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, which the main theme of which is probably the most recognisable opening in the history of the movies, became a huge seller all over the world.
Yes.
Was covered in this country by Hugo Montenegro, went to the top of the hit parade. He put in a rhythm section, which slightly spoils it, but anyway, there we are. And I think he had a huge effect on the record industry from that point of view. That these were things that stood up on their own, as well as being soundtracks to the...
Yeah, even you could, if you were watching the film,
yeah, and you didn't
still
get fed up with
the
them.
Music.
There was enough interesting going on to keep your interest separate from the movie. Bernardo Bertolucci, the director, said once that, as a joke, that there wasn't a single Italian movie made between 1968 and 1975 that wasn't scored by Ennio Morricone, which isn't quite
it's
true, but it almost seemed like it. Certainly the ones that we got to see, the ones which were dubbed and which came over to England, it always seemed to have Morricone. And they had a chance to work together in 1976 with this extraordinary film called Novecento 1900, which is an epic about the rise of communism in Emilia, in Italy, where Bertolucci came from, and the rise of fascism. And it begins with liberation in 1945. And the credits are just wonderful, actually. I actually burst into tears when I first saw them. It's a famous painting by an Italian painter called Volpedo, called The Fourth Estate, which is workers and peasants walking towards you, this sort of whoosh of history coming towards you, the dispossessed, the people don't talk about. And the credits had a reproduction of this painting, starting off with a detail and slowly pulling out, accompanied by this anthem by Morricone romanza, as he called it. Dee, 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 dee. It's a great piece of music, and it's a kind of, you know, in the mid-70s, we were all very interested in Marxism and student politics and all the rest of it, and that moment really captured the moment for me. It's elation you get listening to it, and it still works, I think. Novecento.
People associate him with Westerns, but he crossed all the genres. I mean, light comedy came first, and then he got into the giallo and poliziotesco genres.
Yep.
What do you think about his work in those two genres?
Well, the thrillers in Italy are known as gialli, yellows, because the cheap paperback versions of thrillers have a yellow jacket. And if you go to an Italian bookshop today, you see rows and rows of these Italian paperbacks, these yellow paperbacks, gialli. And the first that Morricone scored was in 1969, just after Once Upon a Time in the West. Now, one of the people who wrote the original story of Once Upon a Time in the West was Dario, the young Dario Argento,
yeah,
who was then a film critic for Paese Sera, an evening Roman newspaper. And Argento had his own ambition to become a director. So his first film as a director is called The Bird with Crystal Plumage. And it's quite a nasty film about a serial killer. I won't do any spoilers because there's quite a sort of revelation in it.
Yeah.
The entire film goes in a certain direction. And in the last 5 minutes, it completely turns over what you thought you were watching. But we'll say a serial killer dressed in black leather with black gloves. You can't see any aspect of them, who preys on... it looks as though this serial killer preys on vulnerable women. And the key scene is an American living in Rome, played by Tony Musante, who stands outside an art gallery and gets trapped between two sliding glass doors, which won't open. And he's trapped between in a sort of glass sandwich, and he's watching this horrible thing as this serial killer in black is attacking this woman, and he can't do anything about it, and he can't be heard. And Morricone decided as his theme for The Bird with Crystal Plumage, which is really creepy, to have a la-la-la, a sort of simple, childlike theme, like a really unpleasant, nasty child humming a nursery rhyme. So while all these horrible things are going on the screen, you get this romantic, sentimental, childlike lullaby. Mm. He's really playing again. It's not Bernard Herrmann Hitchcock stuff with thundering strings in the shower scene of Psycho. Beep, beep, beep. It's not like that at all.
No.
It's just this very spiteful child humming a lullaby, but on the screen, all sorts of nasty things are going on.
Towards the end of his career, he did a lot of concerts. Yeah,
yeah? Absolutely. In his 80s, he went...
Incredible.
In fact, I once introduced Ennio on the stage of the Albert Hall. It was on his 80th birthday. And he he was prepared. He had this funny thing about Westerns, that in England, everyone associated him with Westerns. And I mean, he once said, "I only scored 35 Westerns." Only, Christ, that's more than anybody's ever done. But
I only scored 35 Westerns. Yeah. Is that what
he said? 7% of my output. He said, very precise. 35 Westerns, which is more than Elmer Bernstein, Jerome Morris, and all the rest of them put together. But nevertheless, only 35. And he was prepared to put into his concerts symphonic versions of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where a clarinet takes the sound. Mm. And also Once Upon a Time in the West, because it's a much more orchestral theme. But he wouldn't include in his concerts the first two films, Fistful of Dollars and A Few Dollars More, which have this rather rough gypsy mariachi trumpet sound and the Fender Stratocaster and all that. Mm. So I was a bit naughty. So I stood on this. There he was standing there waiting to start the concert. And I went to the microphone in the Albert Hall and I said, you know, welcome to Maestro Morricone. Everyone applauds like mad. And I said, of course... some of us in the audience really associate him with, and I whistled the theme from Fistful of Dollars, and I said, "That's the last you're going to hear of that tonight." And everyone absolutely loved it. They stood up and applauded. Lord. Morricone glared at me, but he forgave me in the interval. But I thought, I've got to get this in somewhere.
Absolutely.
But he never did those early themes. He did much more orchestral things. But yes, he hit the road, did a lot of touring. In fact, his last concert at the O2, autumn 2018, which was round about his 90th birthday, November 2018. And he had a special seat made for him where he looked as though he was standing for conducting because he had a very bad back. I mean, he's 90 years old, you know, standing on the stage, and he was actually leaning back while he conducted. But he still did several encores and finished up with The Ecstasy of Gold, and there wasn't a dry eye in the O2. I mean, this amazing theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with the soaring soprano line. There she was on the stage, the soprano. And he turned around and he almost smiled. Not quite, being Ennio Morricone, but almost. Yeah. It was a good moment.
And he spent his whole life in Rome, right? He didn't like trade. No desire to go to America.
No, he did. He had been to America, and I think the mission was recorded in London. Mm-hmm. But no, he always said, you know, I want to get back and support Rome football team.
Right, right.
And his apartment was extraordinary. He had the whole floor of a palazzo, a Renaissance palazzo, off the Piazza Venezia in Rome. And the whole length of this apartment was a gigantic sort of late medieval tapestry. Mm. And then this secret room with the metal door. It was the most extraordinary place, and you could see why he loved it there. I mean, it was so Roman, everything about it, historic heritage Rome. And he was very, very secretive. He didn't play the game, didn't go to parties, didn't take critics all that seriously, wasn't part of the sort of fun and games showbiz world at all. He kept himself to himself, a workaholic, I mean, formidable worker. You know, every day he'd go to mass every day and then start even before that at maybe 4 or 5 in the morning, filling out all this manuscript paper. And he lived for his work and kept going till the end.
Let's hope that his legacy lasts forever, and I'm sure it will.
Yeah, yeah. And not just in film music. I mean, Hans Zimmer has said, you know, he's in a class alone. He's above all of us. And in fact, Hans Zimmer, you know, with all those wailing women in Gladiator and things, comes straight from Morricone's use of the soprano voice. Yeah. There's no question. So he's very, very highly rated in the world of film music. But in the world of classical music, too, you get classical composers saying some of his musical ideas live on. Oh, no, he's going to live for a very long time. And, of course, if you have the complete... A friend of mine in Italy has every record that Morricone ever produced.
Wow, that's something.
It's a unique form of roof insulation.
That's something.
It is hundreds of records.
My God.
And singles. I mean, extraordinary.
Well, thank you very much, Sir Christopher.
It's been great fun. Thank you very much for having me.